Hi, welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer from Now Magazine, and really, thanks for listening. This week's episode is another first. John McClane is the first person to appear on this show who has opened for Radiohead. I mean, that was in his other career as a member of the Beta Band before he transitioned into filmmaking full-time. His delightful short film, Pitch Black Heist, first teamed him with Michael Fassbender, and the two are back together for McClane's first feature, The Deconstructionist's Slow West, starring Fassbender as a gunslinger in 1870 Colorado who befriends a Scottish tenderfoot played by Cody Smit-McPhee. It's really good, and it opens in Toronto and Calgary later this week. So as part of his Toronto promotional tour, McClane came to this show with a mild case of jet lag and a pretty serious movie. Roman Polanski's Chinatown, a stylish, merciless reinvention of film noir that stands as one of the best American movies ever made. It stars Jack Nicholson as a Los Angeles private eye who chases a hinky adultery case into a waking nightmare of rotten corruption that somehow revolves around Faye Dunaway's very troubled Evelyn Mulray. And if you've never seen it, seriously, don't listen to this episode because we spoil the crap out of it. You simply can't discuss Chinatown without digging into its secrets. Chinatown was nominated for 11 Academy Awards, but won just one for Robert Towne's magnificent original screenplay. In any other year, that would seem insane. But 1974 was the year of The Godfather Part II, in the conversation, and it would be hard to fight those off. That said, 4 decades later, Chinatown does seem like the more ferocious and accomplished work, a self-contained genre exercise that's lost absolutely none of its power. Of course, if you've seen it, you know. This is someone else's movie.
And I'm just always fascinated by the choices. And this is the first time, like, this is the first time that someone has picked a monster, a big film.
Okay.
So,
I mean, the funny thing is that there's films that I know inside out and back to front. And Chinatown, even though it's kind of my favorite film, isn't one of them because I always kind of forget a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's why I love it so much because. Yeah. Every time you watch it, you kind of, you know, it's not like Die Hard where everything's really, really kind of memorable.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even though it is, it's something kind of, anyway.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. Die Hard has a specificity where you almost picture someone graphing out the location of every character in the building.
Yeah.
For every
scene.
Yeah,
exactly, yeah.
And I watched it again on Saturday night, and I had completely forgotten, just forgotten, that Burt Young plays a role in the final act. I blanked it.
Yeah,
I,
yeah.
He goes back. I mean, you see him at the beginning of the film. And you're like, oh, that's right, he's in this. And then, it's a good 105 minutes. He's never mentioned. Like now, you'd have 3 scenes where he encounters him at a lunch counter or something. Oh,
yeah,
how are you doing?
Fine. Yeah.
It's just a schematic.
Yeah.
But it's so graceful and so elegant about it. It's just, it's one of those double miracles. It's a miracle that it exists at all, and then that it works.
Yeah.
That, you know, like someone would make a film this ambitious
in
1974 when you could say, oh, I'm making a 1930s film noir update about Water and Power, which, you know, the original title of the film and all that. And I'm building it on the bedrock of actual history that no one cares about. I mean, no one, like everyone in the 70s, I went back, I looked at the reviews, and they're like, this is really hard to follow, and I don't understand what this means, and now it's really very clear.
Yeah.
And I'm sure, and this is me being a nerdy film critic, talking about my predecessors 40 years ago, but I'm sure it was pretty simple to follow then, too, because Polanski's such a clear filmmaker.
Yeah.
There's not a wasted breath in those frames.
Yeah.
Like, everything, you're always looking where you need to look, you're always seeing what you need to see. But yeah, on first experience, it's dense, but it's not impossible. So what was your first encounter with it?
I think I must have watched this as part of late night double bills of a cinema I worked in in Edinburgh called The Cameo. And there was 2 ushers, I was one of them. And we had to watch one film, you know, invigilate. And I watched a lot of great films, and Chinatown, I think, was one of them. I think the first thing is the pace and the camera and the almost like the costume and the colour and all the just the perfection of all the elements together, rather than films I'd seen before that either had a strong script but was slightly sold out, or there was other films that had slightly weak script but was visually stunning. Right. It seemed like the first film that every single thing was at the highest. It could be from costume to dialogue to colour to the film quality to the action to the dialogue to, you know, just sort of across the board tens or something.
Yeah, it is remarkable. It's like a powerhouse. It's an all-star team. Like everybody, Richard Silverberg thing, but even the score is rich and lush in a way that maybe people weren't expecting at the time, but certainly now seems even more.
Yeah, and I mean the score as well, which I've got in soundtrack, and it's kind of the other beauty about the camera work and the score is that they're slightly invisible as well in a way. I mean, they're sort of brilliant, but they're not kind of, it's not Jaws or, you know, it's, and the camera work as well, it's, yeah, I guess the score, people would naturally expect kind of Bugsy Malone style music or something, you know.
I mean, even movies in the 30s didn't have that music.
Yeah.
Like, it's a really strange sort of atonal choice.
Yeah.
And it also, it occurred to me watching it again this time that it seems to serve, it would be, it is where the narration would be.
Yeah.
In a hard-boiled private detective movie, because it's only when you're approaching something or when you're when characters are pausing and thinking, and the most violent, vivid scenes are silent.
Yeah,
they have no score. Like, all the brutality is blunt and awful.
Which, funnily enough, I did with Slow West, so that must have been a subliminal influence. But I think for the same reason, dialogue, score over dialogue, really annoys the hell out of me sometimes.
Yeah, so. It gets in the way. I mean, it can. It all comes down to who's using it and how.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing too is that Chinatown really, like, it's not a, it's a driving narrative, but it is very slow and patient.
Yeah.
Sort of lures you in.
I mean, I watched Miller's Crossing again recently, and the first time I saw that, I loved it, and then watching it again, I found it so kind of plot heavy. There's, it seemed to be all about plot, really.
Yeah.
Everything was kind of like, he did this and he was... Whereas Chinatown does have that dreamlike... Like, you could... I think I could watch it with the sound off and still get the idea, you know, because the major... I don't think it matters, and I don't think Polanski probably thought it mattered, like, who did what. I think the overall overriding thing is... people are corrupt.
Yes.
And John Huston's the most corrupt.
Yeah, everything's awful and it's only going to get worse.
But just, you know, making a film out of a series of kind of memorable moments, really.
Yeah.
From Polanski's cameo to...
Yeah,
I don't know. Yeah, I was thinking about sort of what how an American would have made it as well, and there is that other thing which I relate to the Slow West, which is Europeans looking at this very American genre and very American subject.
Yeah, spectatorship changes things. I think.
Yeah,
like the way you've, you know, if you've grown up away from it, or even, I mean, I'm assuming that I'm lived my whole life in Toronto, but I'm pretty sure most of my impressions of New York and LA were formed by the movies that I saw. Mm. Dealt with a heightened form of it, and certainly the LA of Chinatown is something that's alien to pretty much anybody who watched it ever, because unless you lived there in the 30s, this is not the world that it is now. That's the whole point.
Yeah.
The idea that they keep talking about this valley, which is some sort of nightmarish wasteland, and what we know now of it is so completely different, and it barely exists in the same dimension. But the beauty of the vehicles and the clothes and the cars. Yeah. I mean, he's stylizing it anyway, but that was a really stylized era. And the sense that you're watching a construction of that, but the way that Polanski presents it is, it's the best construction. It's the most vivid, you know, these cheap threadbare PIs, the cops, they all still dress really nicely.
Yeah.
They're just, you know, they're not good people.
Yeah.
And that kind of gives you that sense that even though everything is really clean and everything is appointed and manicured, you still have, you know, saltwater poisoning things and a sense of rot from the inside.
Yeah.
And it's the kind of thing where, or the kind of milieu that makes you completely hate just existing in it.
Yeah.
Because you see what it does to people. I mean, and that's, I honestly, I'm stunned by Faye Dunaway every time I see it, and more so every time, yeah. Because you, like, that first time I saw it, I thought her performance was pretty twitchy. I mean, yeah. You know, that's what she was known for, sort of a neurotic energy.
Mm.
And then the second time, and the third time, and the fourth time, you realize, no, this is actually, like, this is someone who in 1974 researched abuse survivors. Like, she was looking into that because she's, there's that one moment where, Giddy says, without knowing anything about her situation, he says, I know what you're hiding. And she, not only does she blanch, but you can sort of see her flipping through what he could possibly know.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, what secret can I tell? Yeah. What am I able to betray about myself, and how hard it is for her to talk about anything that's happened? And it's just, you know, again, that role was written and then performed that way is remarkable to me. It's, and for 1974, where you would even get to that point in the subject matter where a film produced by a major studio, after they'd taken all the creepy sex stuff out of The Godfather, Evans obviously felt it was okay to go for it this time. But it's an ugly, ugly movie for all of its beauty.
Yeah, and I think that's, I'm sure that's probably what Mad Men tried to capture, because that kind of, if you do ugliness with gritty, like Mean Streets or something, then it's, well, Mean Streets is almost a flip. It's sort of, you know, beauty and character is done with ugly grittiness, whereas this is, you know, the flip of ugly characters done with beauty, and it's that, that just emphasizes the point, I think.
And the that elegance that everyone has is, you know, it's aspirational. You sort of want to, again, part of the mythology of Los Angeles, you want to be there. You want to be in that, you know, imagining what it would be like to drink tea, iced tea, and eat a trout head with John Huston. And then, of course, you realize what that costs, what you'd actually have to give up to do those things. It's it's a film where, I mean, I know what's happening. I know everything about it at this point. I've seen it 9 or 10 times all the way through, and gone back to it a number of other ways. But it's nauseating. Like, I just, it's so, I don't know any other filmmaker, maybe Ben Wheatley with Kill List, but I don't know any other filmmaker who can top Polanski for that sort of twisting dread. You know, it's, it's in Repulsion, it's in Rosemary's Baby, but this is sort of,
I guess it's a horror film, Chinatown.
Yeah.
I mean, the first time I watched it, I remember being incredibly confused by why it was called Chinatown. And I think it's just that layers, you know, that's why I said I can't quite, it seems to be more layered than so many other films. And you can watch a film now and love it, like Mad Max or something, and it's just, it's there.
Yeah.
And you watch it. But then when you've got a film like Chinatown, which has got the layer of noir, crime, entertainment, and then below that the layer of production value and all that, then below that the layer of the drama of the mother sister.
Right.
And then even below that you've got this Chinatown layer that's just kind of, you know, you never see what happened, and you know, you never, as you say, you never have these scenes where you know, nowadays there might be a flashback, you know,
to
him as a cop, and or, you know,
I mean, even like, it's true, like, even in Casablanca we have, we'll always have Paris, but we know what it means because we've spent 15 minutes there. Here the echo line of as little as possible at the end is just wow. It's chilling. I'm actually just realizing how you'd have to fight for that. And of course it's not the original ending, that it isn't where Town thought it would go, although I suppose that line could still be the echo.
But again, you know,
they just found a way to create that sort of
But and then, you know, Town creating what seems to be the perfect screenplay and often regarded as one of the best of all time, and then still Polanski changing it is another kind of like wow, you know,
and being right to do so. I mean, that's the, you know, it's the, you hear every now and then that you know, a television series will completely be redefined. Justified is an example that's great, because the pilot ended with Raylan Givens killing Boyd Crowder, shooting him dead, and Walton Goggins as Boyd Crowder was so charming and so much fun, even though he was a horrible person in the episode, that the producers just, they reshot the last scene and said, ah, good thing you missed his heart. And he stayed for the entire series. He just never went away and became the heart of the show, was the relationship between those two. It's, you know, being able to see that coming and just sort of say, you know, it would be better. And especially with someone like Robert Towne, who's a fairly imperious writer, as I understand it, he defends his work ferociously.
Yeah.
But Polanski, I guess there was that tiny little window where you just couldn't argue with him.
Yeah.
I mean, not only was there everything he'd been through personally,
and
he was kind of using that as a shield for a lot of stuff
in
the 70s, and that's something else that's really weird that we kind of have to get in. You can't not discuss that aspect of it.
Yeah.
But that he overruled him and made that work, and that it is now of a piece with his filmography rather than Towne's, is really fascinating to me. But Polanski is, I mean, this is the film that Polanski made with Nicholson. This is, you know, the sort of seed of all of all of the troubles that followed. And I don't want to make it sound like I'm dismissing, you know, the rape of a minor, the drugging and rape of a minor, because it's a horrible crime. And I do believe that Hollywood was such that, you know, had he stayed and dealt with it, it would be in his, it would be over. It would be completely in his past now.
Yeah.
But he fled.
Yeah.
And so now there is this taint hanging over everything he does, which is, you know, you don't have to like an artist to appreciate the art, but Christ, this is the test case, right?
Well, I mean, look at Woody Allen. I mean, you can get away with a lot, and if your films are good enough, it's, I mean...
Yeah, sorry, I'm not going to...
No, I mean, I think it's not the problem of the viewer. I think it's the problem of the industry, and between the industry and the police, you know.
Yeah.
But the viewer, I think, it is difficult. Because, I mean, I'm thinking of rock musicians now that are getting found out for horrific things in the past.
Oh, God,
and,
of course,
you know, and then you'd sort of burn their records or get rid of the records if you had any of those kind of records.
Yeah. Well, and in England, there's the Jimmy Savile case, which is just poison the memories of adults for generations.
So, you know, there's no way you'd suddenly buy an episode of Jimmy Savile and say it's great, you know.
Yeah.
Whereas there is something about, Polanski and the Europeans idolise him, and the French and the...
I think he's still the only fugitive from justice who's got two or three Criterion titles. That's the level of pantheon.
Yeah.
Where, you know, screw the optics, these are films that are deserving of preservation and celebration. And I agree with that. I think, unfortunately, that's the problem that you can never escape.
Yeah, I'm surprised someone's not made a film of the life of Polanski.
Well, there have been a couple of documentaries, but they always feel really... there's one where he very clearly worked with...
Laurent Bouzereau.
The guy who produces all the special feature documentaries, or produced all the docs for Universal. He did, I'm going to screw this up, but he did, I think he did Spielberg's series, all the behind-the-scenes docs, and he's the go-to guy for that sort of thing, and he made a film about Polanski that was, very much an authorized biography.
Right.
And then there's Roman Polanski, Wanted and Desired, which is still kind of sympathetic to him. I think if you're a filmmaker, even if you want to go in and condemn the man, if you're working with his films, you sort of have to acknowledge that level of genius on one level, on one side. And now it sounds like I'm about to excuse it. but it's really remarkable, because Chinatown is an ugly, ugly, ugly movie. I mean, it's a movie made with this sort of coiled rage. And you see... You know, this time watching it and doing the timeline of Sharon Tate and everything in my head, I was trying to figure out, okay, is Polanski actually showing Nicholson what rage looks like? In the two scenes where he's brutal, he's horrifying in his rage, in his violence.
Yeah.
Giddies is a guy who dresses well and looks smart and has a quippy comeback, but if he gets, if he has an enemy, he will kill that person if it's allowed. The scene with Mulvihill is just terrifying. Yeah. He jerseys the guy. He pulls his jacket over his head. He pummels him.
Yeah.
And what you see is not just the anger at the previous insult. Like, that's... He's acting a decade of anger.
Yeah.
And, you know, Nicholson's a volatile screen actor.
Yeah.
But this is something. Like, this is a really ugly side.
I think it's sort of... There's a bit of Beware the Little Guy as well.
Yeah.
But,
yeah, it's true. Polanski does cast himself as the person who has almost as much power as Houston, ultimately.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of swagging around, being... Like, the two biggest villains in the film are filmmakers.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting story.
That's interesting. I never thought of that.
Yeah.
But But yeah, the casting of Houston as well is quite incredible.
Yeah, it's one of those roles where everything he does is feeding into it. Everything, like just the way he purses his lips and that strange wheedling thing he does twice, once with Giddies and then he realizes it won't work, and then at the end with her, it's just so horrible.
Yeah.
Like your skin crawls and so yeah, I mean, when you saw it, you were an usher in a movie theater, so presumably you knew who Houston was. He was making films.
No, I was pretty early on in my film education. I was just like 2019, and all my favourite films were really like RoboCop and Predator. I wasn't a cinephile. In fact, the opposite. I thought I was kind of, all my peers at art school were all into kind of Three Colors Red and Jesus of Montreal and like all these art house films that were coming out, and I didn't really like any of them and just loved Predator and Terminator and RoboCop. So
Predator and Terminator are hard films.
Yeah.
So much of Predator is silent. It's really remarkable. I watched it again last year.
Yeah. No, I still hold them, and I say Die Hard, I still hold all these high, and you know, when you go back and analyse them, especially compared to blockbusters now and stuff.
Sure.
And kind of a lot of them at that time very anti-military, you know, RoboCop and
much more cynical,
Die Hard so I just thought I wasn't really into cinema because I liked that. And then think about 1990, Tarantino came with Reservoir Dogs to the cinema and did a talk, and that's when I realised that there was such a thing as B-movies, and this was a filmmaker that was allowed to do violence and still be art house, so that opened lots of doors. But I think it wasn't until long after I started watching Houston films and
I knew him. I'm a little bit older than you, I guess. I knew him as the guy who made The Man Who Would Be King. That was the only one I knew at the time when I first saw Chinatown.
Different from all his other films.
Yeah, right? It's joyful.
Yeah.
And, it's really, it's so much fun.
Yeah.
And I might have even seen them both. There must have, the Blur Cinema, I'm sure it was the Blur Cinema, the old rep theater here, programmed both of them one night. It was the second time I'd seen Chinatown, and the first time I'd ever seen Man Who Would Be King in a theater.
Right.
And it was just back to back. It's just like, oh, okay, there's absolutely no middle ground. That's a personality clash between filmmaker and filmmaker, between actor and director, who's the same human being. That was remarkable. That was a formative memory for me, just realizing, you can do radically different things if you choose to.
Yeah.
And Houston, by all accounts, you know, an irascible fellow, but not a monster, just find something.
Yeah. Have you read White Hunter Dark Black? That book. I mean,
he's not a good person.
No. Not in that book. But
but I guess the difference is he didn't direct it at people.
Yeah.
Maybe that's it. Like he was sort of he bought into that whole Hemingway adventurer thing.
Yeah.
Like, it's almost forgivable, that image of masculinity at the time.
Yeah. But that's the other kind of remarkable thing about Chinatown is that Polanski had the balls to even cast.
Yeah.
I'm such a giant of cinema, you know, it's kind of...
Yeah. I always wondered if Spielberg sort of did that deliberately with Truffaut in Close Encounters right after.
Yeah.
Just on his mind, I can get away with that.
Yeah.
But, and it is sort of, and the other thing about mentioning Spielberg makes me realize, of course, that Chinatown, it wasn't the end of the Renaissance, but it was the beginning of the end. Like, 1974 is when the American revolution in cinema started to slow down.
Yeah.
And here you have Polanski making a big, expensive studio picture. It's sort of the beginning of the end. You've got, and you know, realizing too, watching it this time, I was thinking, wow, Nicholson and Dunaway together, they were the faces of it. I mean, other than Beatty and Redford, maybe, but, you know, like Nicholson had made Easy Rider and Five Easy, he was already the indie guy.
Yeah.
And Dunaway was in Bonnie and Clyde, of course. Yeah. So, like, this was their sell out. This might have been their selling out if it hadn't been good.
Mm.
And instead, of course, they're just, they're the anchors of a big studio picture in a way that maybe other actors at the time might not have been.
Yeah.
Because they're willing to be like kind of real and raw enough. Yeah. It's the amalgamation, I suppose, of that sort of industry and the independent wave, mm. where suddenly you saw what was possible. I mean, you know, 74 was Earthquake and Towering Inferno and other films that used a lot of really talented actors but didn't give them anything to do. This is the movie that, you know, catalyzes it.
Well, Echoes of Today. But there's playing with genre, I think, you know, in the sort of... Well, something I've just recently found out playing with genre is that people do expect, you know, they expect a certain thing. And I think if people went in expecting a noir film with a femme fatale and a detective and saw Chinatown, then it's really going to disappoint.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know.
It's surprising how much of the future you can feel in it, too. I mean, Nicholson's performance... I never really caught it before, or maybe I've just gotten jaded and learned to expect these things, but you can see Harrison Ford in there, you can see Dennis Quaid in there. Things are going to get lifted from Gittes, which is interesting.
Yeah.
Dunaway is sort of unreplicable. I can't see anybody coming away from that and thinking, I want to do that.
No.
I would admire that.
Yeah.
But then, as well, Blade Runner is Chinatown. Like, it's stunning. They're both about ineffectual detectives who make things worse, mm-hmm. who are exhausted and overconfident, are manipulated, get far in over their heads. There's the sci-fi trappings in Blade Runner, but they're irrelevant the same way
that exactly.
the past genre stuff is irrelevant to Chinatown.
Mm.
It is like it's a map to what comes next.
Well, and even Rango, you know, the...
Lucasfilm, Red Island.
Well, look, is obviously Chinatown as well, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And so the same story can be told in 2000 and whenever for children, you know, which is kind of remarkable as well.
It is. I find myself wondering how we ended up here when, you know, the roadmap in the late 60s, early 70s was just so good that now, you know, it's all about CGI fighting CGI and monsters and... Well, Transformers, and it's just what people want, I suppose.
I don't think so. I think it's consumerism at its best, worst, but I think it's just the same as everything else has gone, from house building to MP3s instead of vinyl to... It's just things... The lust for people getting rid of old... companies wanting people to get rid of old stuff and get new stuff that's going to break down quicker and doesn't sound as good and doesn't look as good, you know, probably started around the mid 70s, I guess, it started long before, but definitely, you know, that was, as you say, the heyday of the best film stock and the best recording techniques on vinyl and great speaker systems and valve amps for guitar, you know, everything was like, and then suddenly the 80s and, you know, everything slowly crumbled, but people don't seem to mind. I don't know.
It's so depressing.
Yeah, I know.
It really is.
I know.
I wonder how, you know, people sort of react to movies, to 80s movies becoming canonized now, and not the good ones, the ones they grew up watching on cable. You know, everybody's... Earlier this week, apparently, someone figured out, based on the ball teams that play in Ferris Bueller's Day Off, was the 30th anniversary of the day itself. Even though they invented all of that.
Right.
But the game is like, well, they played on that day. This must be the day. And it was a weekday, so then he would have cut school. Just the obsession over that. Yeah, I mean, Ferris Bueller's a pretty good movie.
Yeah,
but
that's a great movie.
The celebration of that aspect of it, like, we cracked this code. It's not a code. It's not a secret. It's people investing so much into something from the past because there's nothing to invest in now.
Yeah, but I haven't said that. I mean, without being... Because I'm not kind of... too much of a retro kid that I don't think that, you know, I think still in 30 years time people are probably going to be looking back at now and saying there was some great stuff now, And I guess there is.
Yeah. We just have to wait and see what it is. Wait for it to surface.
Yeah. And there's always... I mean, even this year, even in the last 6 months, I've seen some great films. And, you know, even in the last couple of months, I went to see Force Majeure, which is fantastic. Yeah. Mad Max I liked. And, you know, so...
There's hope.
There's always hope. And, you know, it's just... It's funny because... I was getting a bunch of 1 out of 10 kind of scores on IMDb for Slow West. And
really?
I was like, oh, interesting. You know, I thought you'd have to be a real cynical bastard to think this is 1 out of 10. You know, I think, you know, if you hate it, you give it 5, you know, because there's a lot, you know. And then I started thinking, well, okay, let's think of some films where there's no way that anyone would write a 1 out of 10 review. And I was like, Back to the Future, you know, and there's just loads. Yeah. I was like, E.T., loads. Chinatown, just loads. And a lot of the 1 out of 10 reviews, I started reading them for Chinatown. It's like, you know, how slow it is. And it's just so depressing that people think that Chinatown's slow.
Yeah.
And it probably did then as well, as you say, but why are people in such a rush?
Yeah.
Why don't you just... let it slow your life down.
Yeah. I mean, I don't even accept that it's 2 hours and 10 minutes. It's not even long. Like, it's an average length for a film at that
and
time.
And as you say, it's economical. Mm-hmm. It's not like... We're not talking Tarkovsky. I mean, even though he's a master, where it's not... You don't have to work out what the shots mean.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all pretty obvious what they mean, because it's story-led.
Mm-hmm. And it's beautifully put together. I mean, there are a lot more single takes than I thought there were. Mm. I mean, I know I've noticed this before, and every time I find myself noticing it again, just because the economy of it is just lovely. I mean, there's that conversation in the car, and there's the thing early on, and there's just walking scenes. The scene in the morgue is, I think there are 2 shots. There's a reverse, and then it just continues as a single take, and it's just... Of course you would. Why wouldn't you? Like, it's about dialogue. It's about feeling people out. It's about watching these characters get the measure of each other.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also seamless. It's the... You know, there's that BuzzFeed article. I'm sure it was BuzzFeed. The 10 long takes you've never noticed, and one of them is the raft ride in Jaws where...
Yes. Yeah. I watched that. Yeah.
And you do notice it, and you're like, that's... Of course you would. Yeah. Why wouldn't you? You get 5 pages done.
Yeah.
It's a way to make the movie shoot go faster.
Genius of Spielberg as well.
Yeah. But Chinatown has it everywhere.
I mean,
it's just like, it's casual, the relationship to space and frame. And of course, it's a period film. There's that one scene where they're picking up their cars after he meets Mulray at the restaurant, the hotel, I think. Mm-hmm. It's a club. And there are period vehicles in the background, like 2 blocks away. I think that's the Hind of Beverly Wilshire. That must have cost a fortune.
Yeah.
And it's redressed, and there are, you know, no opticals, no CGI. This is just a shot.
Mm-hmm.
But it gets it all there. Like, you feel the world around them in a way when they're having a really intimate conversation too, where she can't quite bring herself to tell them anything.
Mm-hmm.
And you're so invested in them that if a Chevy van drove by, no one would see it.
Yeah.
But it's crafted and designed.
Mm-hmm.
So this is where I shifted onto your work. So you've made a period film. And you're shooting in New Zealand.
Yes.
Which is not the West as we know it.
No.
But was it easier to build that unreality, to create the sense that you're in 1870?
New Zealand was practical reasons. So, yeah, there would have been more compromise shooting in Colorado. So, just realizing that, you know, if you move a set, you lose 2 days, you know.
Yeah.
And this is a road movie going through lots of different landscapes, so you'd have to move in Colorado 4 hours to even get out of a forest.
Right.
So New Zealand was just easier.
It does give the film sort of an unworldly sense.
Yeah.
That you've created an unreal frontier that's, you know, simultaneously confrontational. And
yeah, I mean, that was a byproduct, I mean, of kind of trying to find, because I've travelled around Colorado quite a lot, and being in New Zealand and really trying to find the bits that I felt were really close, you know, because I think if I'd started, New Zealand's full of, like, there'd be a, I'd be filming like this, and you're thinking, this looks pretty much like Colorado. But if you move the camera there, then you're in Switzerland, and it's like lakes and snow-capped mountains. And then behind you looks like Japan with, like, peaks. And so, I mean, that's where New Zealand, you just, yeah, so it was sort of trying to do it as much as my experience of Colorado as possible, then, you know, people find out that it's not, but when they're watching the film, they won't obviously immediately go, this isn't Colorado. They'll just go, something quite not unfamiliar about this, you know.
Yeah, and the film itself is a little bit stylized to begin with, and just sort of put them, in, put them in sort of on the wrong foot from the beginning.
Yeah.
And you're dealing with, and this is the other connection to Chinatown I was kind of thinking of when you said you wanted to do Chinatown, is that as much as J.J. Geddes is sort of the archetypal private detective, he really isn't. And what we have with Fassbender's character in Slow West is someone who's, you know, this is what I said before when we spoke about the film, is that it is it's the best introduction he's ever had because he materializes. He's just, he has this mythic carriage to him.
Yeah.
But that's not who he is either.
Yeah.
So that, for me, seemed to be the weird sort of psychic connection between the two films.
Yeah.
Both about leads who aren't leads in their own stories.
I mean, there was a few discussions about his entrance because, you know, a few people would be saying, this is Fassbender, you've got to show him. And I was like, I don't want to show him. You know, let's keep him, you know, there's no close-ups all the way up until he's looking at the wanted poster, you know, but that was kind of deliberate. And but we almost filmed that in chronological order, so people were starting to talk. Like, he's not shot Fassbender yet, you know, the money shot. So it was definitely a conscious thing, and it was definitely something that I was feeling a bit of heat for.
Yeah. I love what he's doing with his career. It's a fascinating choice, but he's as complicit in his exploitation as a couple of other actors I can think of, where he's really aware of how he's being used on camera.
Oh, definitely.
He plays trust in a way that's really interesting. Like, I know when he's comfortable.
Yeah.
Even if he's not playing a comfortable character.
Yeah. And he's not a scene stealer either. He's sort of very respectful for the story and whoever's important in that scene. And if he's sort of, because there was one or two scenes where he really was kind of not a voyeur, you know, just kind of like a member of the audience, you know, and quite a lot. Even the end siege, he's sort of, you know, spectating. So it was, you know, doubly impressive acting for him to remain, you know, everyone sort of in reviews saying Fassbender's brilliant, and, you know, that's down to him, because it was a lot of the time just really a subtle performance.
Yeah. No, he's a great reactor.
There was a bit in Slow West that he did that I absolutely love, and it's just when Cody, they've got the two horses and the paying posse are up on the ridge, and Cody says to Michael, whose side are you on? And Michael sort of goes, I'm going to go and punch you. No, I'm not. I'm going to... And it's like, it's just such a great bit of acting.
Yeah, it's powerful.
And I probably didn't even notice it until editing, you know, because it's just a tiny thing. It's just, instead of just getting on his horse or any of that, so I might have gone, you know, but just that kind of, the way he's just sort of moved his body to suggest everything, you know, is like amazing.
Yeah. So the last question is the auteur question. Is there anything from Chinatown that you harvested for your own work? Not necessarily Slow West, but Pitch Black Heist or anything else you've done?
Definitely Pitch Black Heist, because, again, it's static camera. Only move the camera if, you know, if it's a gliding, no handheld, same as Slow West. So definitely the camera. The costumes and colour, you know, the colour reference of that film. And, you know, even though it's a noir film, there's nothing really shadowy about it. It's all quite bright and, you know, and that I think that adds again to the horror in the same way as the, as you say, everyone's well dressed and it looks like a world you want to be part of or something. But
I think
my favorite color films are Lee Marvin and Point Blank. Yeah. And Chinatown. Just the color of the I don't know whether it's a mixture between the costume design, prop designer, and the production and the stock, film stock, but together they just, it seems like the perfect things got up to that point of film and color and then kind of went away again, you know. But I think definitely they were color references for Slow West. And yeah, just what was it I said at the beginning, because it was something that you said that I didn't realize that I'd done in Slow West, that was probably a reference, probably, I can't remember, but yeah, as well, the things sort of subliminally influence you. So I guess, as you say, like Michael being an archetypal cowboy, but not, and
yeah, or presenting in that fashion.
Yeah, and
the idea of the rotten history underlying everything that comes back to, I mean, the West, the demythologizing of the West, that it's not only a key theme of Slow West, but it's confronted immediately. And in Chinatown, the whole film exists to demythologize Los Angeles, mm-hmm. and the idea of government as a power
and the American dream,
and it's just stripping that away.
Yeah.
And while I don't doubt that Town wrote it all, and it's all in the book, like it's all on the page, but Polanski brings that out in a way that I think a lot of other filmmakers might have just not quite pushed as hard or backed away. And now that level of confrontation with your source material or with the legends that you're using in your story, that's commonplace. We expect it now, that sort of seeded cynicism.
Yeah.
But at the time, this was even, well, Watergate was happening or had happened, I guess. They'd already broken. Like, this is when America started to have that conversation, 10 years after the Kennedy assassination, 11 years. That was a commonplace. The Vietnam War was going on.
Yeah, and Vietnam must have fit into every film of that generation. But definitely.
It's a cynical movie for a cynical time.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like it until the end. That's what amazes me about Chinatown, is that it doesn't hit you all at once.
Mm.
Or, sorry, no, it does. It hits you all at once because you're led there by the hand, by a filmmaker who has authority, so you trust the movie.
Yeah.
And then you're just confronted with this grisly, ugly, the horror and corruption and rot and evil wins. Evil doesn't just win, evil triumphs, evil dances away. Wow, good
job. Yeah, I think because I'm quite a positive person and quite level-headed, I've got a lot of friends that are much darker in mind, and I think because of that, then I can really embrace films like that. Like, I don't quite embrace horror. I go as far as The Shining, but I'm not into the latest horror stuff or anything. I find that just a bit sick. But I think, I definitely think I can sort of watch these films and enjoy them in a way that I think some of our friends would find a bit more disturbing or something. I don't know.
It's like an affirmation that things can be that bad, but it can still be walked away from.
I think I just see it as a story, and I think I just see it as a story well told.
Mm.
And there is a sort of, you can, I think that's why I worked for a cartoon, Rango or whatever, because you can say Once Upon a Time.
Yeah.
And the politics of it, that's still, you still read about now, the rich watering their lawns when there's, bans in LA, it's in the papers last week, naming and shaming rock stars and film stars for watering their massive golf courses and stuff. And so I just think that real life and politics are so much worse than film.
It's true.
That, you know, I can't get too upset about someone telling the story, really. And you know, no matter how dark it is, you know, like, it's the real life stuff that's much more depressing.
Yeah, the lights come up and you can walk away. Now I'm depressed. Uh-huh. My thanks to John McLean, whose film Slow West opens in Toronto and Calgary on June 12th and also appears on premium VOD everywhere in Canada through Soda Pictures. But really, you should try to see it on the big screen if you can. You can find John McLean at Twitter at John Beta Mac, JohnBetaMac. And you should follow him. He's a good guy. Chinatown is available in a really lovely Blu-ray from Paramount Home Entertainment that marries a gorgeous transfer to some really terrific extras, including a feature-length doc called Water and Power that looks at the real history of Los Angeles construction. That's amazing. You should see that. And you can also stream it on Netflix, but, you know, Blu-ray. It's awesome. You can find me online at Norm Wilner on Twitter and elsewhere on the internet at nowtoronto.com. You can also find this podcast at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, or on the internet at someoneelsesmovie.com. If you want to leave a review up on iTunes, you know, we would appreciate that. We being me. I do this by myself. And I try to make it better next time. Thanks for listening.
All of those, I'm afraid you're just too darn loud.